Federal authorities are conducting a review of the sexual assault and harassment policies of the Wisconsin National Guard units in response to misconduct allegations that surfaced in January. We're talking about the situation here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And please be aware that during this conversation, we will be talking about sexual assault and prevention. And this frank discussion may not be suitable for all listeners who are with us at this moment. Your voice is welcome, though, through this discussion at 800-642-1234. Are you a victim of military sexual trauma, or have you worked with a victim of military sexual trauma? What did you or they need in terms of support? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Robert Bragna is a sexual assault response coordinator for the Wisconsin National Guard. Robert, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
And Amber Garfoot is a victim advocate for the Wisconsin National Guard. Amber, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
So let's look at this report. The Associated Press reported that the National Guard received 52 reports of sexual assault between 2013 and 2017. Robert, what is known about these reports?
Well, what's interesting is that this is the first time that we're talking about these numbers. And so what I find interesting, to be quite honest, is how few conclusions you can draw from them. And let me explain. I try to avoid talking about numbers because a lot of the assaults that we have reported to us are incidences that happened prior to the service members' entry into the military. They could have happened as a child. And so only a portion of any reports that we see are related to their military status and duty performance. So the thing is that if we have 52, it could be indication of assaults that occurred, you know, in the past. And there's really no, it's such a varied experience that everybody has. You know, there's active duty experience, National Guard, Reserve, incidences that happen in the United States, and incidences that happen on deployment. And so there's really very little to compare to cases, and there's no conclusion really that I can think that you can draw from numbers.
Amber, how have you seen the way the military responds and records assaults? How has that changed over time?
Well, I've been with this program for about 7 years now, and when I first came in, it was when there was a lot going on in Congress, and the military was testifying in front of Congress about sexual assaults in the military. And from that point on, there's been change after change after change, and positive change. It's just hard to have those positive changes make the news, right? Because unfortunately, it's always the things that maybe are less favorable that end up in the media. But the changes that I've seen over time have been the addition of full-time staff, more dedicated staff, the addition of legal assistance specifically for victims of sexual assault. There's been policy changes and a lot more resources for us to access for service members to receive care that they need after that they've been a victim of sexual assault.
So you see these positive changes. You also see a growing amount of support around these victims who do come forward. It sounds like there are actually more jobs out there like yours, a victim advocate.
Correct. And some of our victim advocates are what we call a dual status. Or they do this as an additional duty to their military service. So they may be a truck driver or a logistics officer or whatever the case may be, and they perform duties as a victim advocate in addition to what they already do. And most of those people who do that they seek that position because they're very passionate about the topic. So we always know that our service members who come forward are in excellent hands because there are a lot of really great passionate people that are in our program.
Robert, the Wisconsin National Guard's procedures are under federal review at the moment. Given the work you do to improve victims' lives, what's the value of this look at the policies and procedures of your work?
Well, so the Wisconsin National Guard is subject as it would be that we have soldiers and airmen from the Army and Air Force. We're subject to the policies that those departments have. We're also subject to the policies of the National Guard Bureau. And so 95% of our policies, procedures, and the way we operate is in accordance with that. There's very little unique to Wisconsin that you wouldn't see in another state's National Guard. What I think is the value of looking at this, especially in this public forum, is that it hopefully will give the public and our service members more confidence in the fact that we, above all else, try to apply a process and make sure that the process is effective. Of course, every process might have a different outcome, and we can't control outcomes, but we can control the process, and that's what we're interested in focusing on.
As you look at this process, what does this process entail as victims come forward? What happens?
Well, people come forward for different reasons. And so some people come forward simply because they want access to some resources. Could be mental health services, could be medical, legal, law enforcement. And especially in cases where their personal experience is little to do with their military experience, it doesn't necessarily become an issue that a chain of command would get involved in. And so oftentimes those folks will file what we call restricted reports, which is unique to the military in the sense that you can come forward, make a report, and a victim advocate, the sexual assault response coordinator, and the victim are really the only ones that know that the report was made. And that's so that in a confidential manner, we can assist the victim and get them access to resources. So people come forward for that. What gets talked about more often is what we call unrestricted reporting, which is where a chain of command does become aware that a service member alleges they were sexually assaulted. If, again, it has nothing to do with military service, it's more or less a awareness that the chain of command have so they can be supportive. If it has something specific to do with their military service, and I'll try to avoid using legal terms because I'm not an attorney. Generally speaking, if it is a sexual assault in general, it's a crime. And the organization acknowledges that. So if the chain of command becomes aware of an allegation, the issue gets referred to law enforcement. In the state of Wisconsin, we don't have any active duty criminal investigative agencies here like CID for the Army or OSI for the Air Force. And so local law enforcement is the agency that has jurisdiction. In the event that an investigation is not pursued or charges are not brought on someone alleged to have committed the crime, and that's for various reasons, it could be a district attorney decides not to prosecute because they think they can't win. It could be that the agency might not have enough resources available to consider it their priority. And so in that case, the Wisconsin National Guard can do an administrative investigation to, at the very least, hold the person administratively accountable, given that there would be no criminal charge brought. Does that make sense?
And this takes time.
Yes.
This whole process takes time.
And, you know, as much as some leaders might want to move swiftly, because we definitely talk about how this is our priority issue, the fact is that the process can be re-victimizing to people, and we take great care to make sure that we're putting the victim in the driver's seat as much as we can. In some cases, swift action is not necessarily what the victim's looking for, and so we try to control the pace based on the best interest of the victim.
The Air Force is investigating allegations of sexual assault and harassment within a Wisconsin Air National Guard security unit that is dating back to 2002. And the investigation came at the request of U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin. We're talking about Wisconsin National Guard prevention efforts and what's being done to change the climate in the military when it comes to sexual assault, sexual trauma. Robert Branya and Amber Garfoot are our guides. They're with the Wisconsin National Guard. Guard members, past and present, how are you feeling about this federal review? What do you think this means for the Guard and the work it does? Let us know. Join in this conversation at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back to this conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about sexual assault prevention efforts in the military. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And if you're just joining us now, please be aware that this is a sensitive subject that might not be appropriate for everyone to hear this half hour. We learned last month that the Wisconsin National Guard has received more than 4 dozen reports of sexual assault between 2013 and 2017, with more than half related to military service. We're talking about this with the National Guard about where to go from here as the Air Force reviews the Wisconsin Guard's sexual assault and harassment reporting procedures, the investigative process, the accountability measures. Getting your thoughts along the way at 800-642-1234. What changes do you want to see when it comes to how our institutions, like the military, respond to sexual assault? What can be made better? What is already an improvement that is going well? You can join in by phone at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Robert Bronya and Amber Garfoot are our guides. They are with the Wisconsin National Guard. And Amber, going back to you as a victim advocate, if the person who is reporting the assault requests for this to stay confidential, what does that mean?
Confidentiality means for a victim coming forward, if in our organization isn't a restricted report. So in that event, if I were to take in a restricted report, I would only be able to talk to Rob about it because he's our sexual assault response coordinator. But that means that our chain of command would have no awareness, the rest of our organization would have no awareness of the report of sexual assault. It's really a matter of keeping that victim in the driver's seat for whatever resources that they would like to get from our program.
So is it possible for the report to be confidential but still be reported to law enforcement?
In our organization, no, it is not. So if we take in a restricted report, there's no law enforcement that is contacted. There is no process that moves forward to seek punishment for that individual accused of the sexual assault, and that is at the request of that particular victim.
Amber, what kind of environment is necessary for victims to come forward, to feel supported, to feel like they can talk?
We talk about this a lot, actually, in our organization, and it's something that we really hone in on. Just this last month during Sexual Assault Awareness Month, it was a big topic of conversation. And I believe personally that individuals need to understand that they're not alone, and that there's lots of survivors of sexual assault, unfortunately, but that they are safe to share their story and connect with others and to find the resources that they need specific to whatever it is that they're, you know, having challenges with from that are a result of their assault. But it really, environmentally, they need to understand that they have a place to go that's safe, and they need to be able to feel safe talking about their assault.
Robert, you know, the military is a difficult place in many ways. There are deployments. There are physical demands. There are mental demands. What does sexual assault prevention entail in that kind of environment?
Well, sexual assault, the dynamics involved are pretty complex in general, in any environment. And so when you add those extra complexities, some of them affect the dynamics and some don't. What I think is our approach as bystander intervention is that people need to be aware of certain behaviors, certain red flags, and that at the end of the day, if something happens that we don't know about, there's not very little we can do. But we don't want to cross into the lane of suggesting prevention, such as being with someone else so that something doesn't happen to you, saying don't be sexually assaulted, so don't go out at night or don't be alone, is really putting the onus on people who are potential victims to prevent the assault from occurring. And that's the kind of training and messaging we try to avoid. So bystander intervention is important, and also helping people understand the issue of consent in general. It really goes back to, we are the only organization in some cases in folks' lives that are talking about this. If we have a large number of our service members who are college students, I can't speak for what goes on at different universities, but if they have 4 years of a college experience and maybe are talked to once about the issue of consent or sexual assault, it doesn't become a part of their college experience. Whereas in our organization, several times a year, they see this issue emphasized and they're provided with contact information, and it's constant education. So we have people that come to our organization because we're talking about it, and that is, I guess, our biggest ally in fighting this.
Yeah, when you say constant education, what is going on proactively on bases to get some of this education about what is okay and not okay in assault prevention?
Well, and I'll give you some specific examples of what we've done, but I want to emphasize education is an uphill battle because it is the case that we have people constantly coming into our organization and constantly leaving. People that do their 4 years, their 6 years, their 8 years, they come and go. People that retire. And any given year, you can go to a unit you were just at and see new faces. And so it's a matter of constantly talking about this. So in addition to constantly talking about it, and we do try to not, you know, bar ourselves in our offices, we try to get out there and get the word out and have people understand that we are people and we're approachable. But we also do certain bigger events to draw more attention. There's a nationally known speaker, Mike Domish, who's come and talked with our organization. We had Elizabeth Smart come here this past April for Sexual Assault Awareness Month. And so we kind of try to get professional focus on this issue and have trainings that our advocates can take, and it's kind of a train the trainer. So when our advocates are at units, they can talk about it as well.
Robert Branya, I'm wondering, is the news coverage and the calls for investigation by Governor Evers and U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin, is that having an effect on the work you're doing or on the people in this branch of the military?
Well, from my experience, and experience is all I can speak to, I feel like the barriers that people face in reporting a sexual assault come down to trust a lot of times. And so helping people understand that this program is victim-centered and that advocates are people who are selected because they're a good fit and that they're empathetic and that we want to help is important. When attention gets paid to this issue and the real story isn't told, you know, the real story of what we have in the state and what's going on, I feel like that runs the risk of just creating more barriers, creating more questions than answers. And, you know, that's my biggest concern.
Amber, one facet of the National Guard is that it is not full time. And Robert just talked a little bit about that flux. Does that have an effect on the level of community support that's available to a member of the Guard if they do report an assault?
No, it does not affect the level of support that they receive. Our victim advocates are able to come on what we call an order at any time to serve that individual. And that's also why we have full-time staff. And we recognize that we have those barriers and we have those challenges at times, but we have good resources put into place to work around those. We also rely heavily upon our community resources. So our service members are part of our community, and in some ways that is a challenge. So when we get people into our organization, they've already had, you know, 17 plus years worth of life experience, and they come from a vast, vast variety of backgrounds. And so their family life may look very different from what someone else's family life experience was. And that very much so affects our culture. And so we're constantly having to work around that. But because they're community members and they have such a variety of backgrounds, we have to rely on a very vast variety of resources to accommodate whatever it is that they really need to be feeling more whole, you know.
As we start to wrap up, I still want to get this question into both of you. Amber, first, you know, what is the most difficult thing about being a victim advocate? What do you grapple with?
For me, the most difficult thing is in some cases where you really feel like maybe something more can be done and you're stuck, you know, and you're feeling like, well, this person doesn't, they don't want their case to go to the court system, but they have a good case to go to the court system. And it's respecting that individual and listening to what they have to say, because at the end of the day, it's not my story to tell. And I'm there for them, and I'm wanting to support them in any way possible. So it's being a really good listener and just really trying to figure out what it is that that individual needs to be successful in a healing process. And whatever that may look like to them may not look like the same healing process to me. So to be an advocate, you really have to be a phenomenal listener, and you have to figure out what it is that someone wants and ask really, really good questions to get to that point.
Robert Branya, what about you?
Well, I think it should be said, and anybody who works in the career field of victim advocacy will agree, it's challenging to make sure that you're taking care of yourself, because this career field tends to draw people who are extremely empathetic, and you'll there's a term, vicarious trauma, that they'll be familiar with. You don't want to make yourself ineffective by investing yourself so much emotionally in your job that it burns you out. As somebody who's been doing this for 11 years, I can tell you that what I find most challenging is keeping myself healthy for the people that I serve.
Robert, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Robert Bragna is a sexual assault response coordinator of the Wisconsin National Guard. Amber, thank you.
Thank you.
Amber Garfoot is a victim advocate for the Wisconsin National Guard, and you hear this conversation on the Ideas Network. NFL Drafts Weekend is behind us. We're getting a read on the Packers' selections during the 2019 NFL Draft and looking ahead to next season and who we should keep an eye on in that 53-man roster. What was your reaction to the Green Bay Packers' draft picks last week? Did the team address your concerns after last season, or do you think Packers still have work to do? Do you want the Packers to pick more weapons for Aaron Rodgers? Join in with your thoughts on the Packers roster, 800-642-1234. Bob McGinn has covered the Green Bay Packers since 1979, most of that time as a writer for Wisconsin newspapers, and he now writes about the Packers and the NFL for his own website, bobmcginnfootball.com. Bob, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks a lot, Kate.
So the Packers had 8 picks in this year's draft and 2 in the first round. Can you briefly explain for us how the draft works?
Yeah, the NFL started on the first draft was in 1936. And, you know, they see college football as their little
feeder
area to get players.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a nice little minor league for them. And the worst teams pick first. The idea is to, you know, create parity within the ranks, give everybody a chance, and it's gone on from there. It used to be like 30 rounds, and now it's down to 7 since 1994, I believe, was the first year was 7.
And how many picks does each team get, and how is that order decided?
One pick per round, so you get 7 picks starting out. You can trade picks at any time. So some teams, the Packers, entered this draft with 10. And again, it's the team that had the worst record the year before picks first, and then onward down to 32.
So in the NFL, how important are these rookie players in general? How valuable are they?
Very. It's your lifeblood. They are the youngest players, obviously, and you have them for a minimum of 4 years contractually, and the rookie wage scale is such that they represent cheap labor, and it's very important. Each team has a salary cap, and it's very important for these players not only to be good but to make the team for financial reasons.
Right, and you know, what is the learning curve like? Are they able to begin playing immediately, or is there a lot of knowledge that they have to gain once they get on the field with their new team?
Again, there's more and more increasingly. 25 years ago or 30 years ago, rookies generally had to sit a year, sometimes two. Coaches didn't want to play young players because they didn't know enough. But nowadays, now again, with this salary cap, which came in 1993, there's a tremendous thrust to have to play your first year, certainly by your second. You can't keep players that long because they're eligible to leave as free agents after 4 seasons. So it's all accelerated, and very rare is the player that can sit for 1 full year, let alone 2, you know, before becoming a key player.
Well, let's take a look at the draft for the Packers. Did you see any overall themes in their selections this year?
A couple. Big schools. Brian Gutekunst, the general manager in his second year, he loves big school guys, particularly from the Southeastern Conference down, and that's where generally the best college football is played, and he likes going down there.
Mm-hmm.
That's one. And then the other would be overall athletic ability and speed of the players he selected. Everybody likes those factors, but not everybody prioritizes that in their draft philosophy, but I think Gutekunst does.
What about defense? It seems like that was a priority in the picks this year.
Yeah, they took five of the eight were defensive players, including the first two, and they've drafted defense quite a bit here the last couple, 3 years. I think the feeling just, you know, at base is that Aaron Rodgers is the man on offense, and he is so good that he can, you know, he can sustain a very effective offense, and they needed help on defense.
So how did the Packers' defense stack up against other teams last year? Where do you see the need to improve?
Well, they weren't very good. I mean, they didn't, you know, there's a million statistics in defensive football, but the number one is how many times you can take the ball away from the opponent. And they were, I think, 32nd last or second last in that department, and that is just critical. And you need people that can rush the passer, knock the ball from the quarterback's hands. You need fast, hard-hitting guys to strip the ball from running backs and wide receivers who have the ball. So they had to try to do that, and I think with the speed we discussed, they may have succeeded. We shall see.
Bob McGinn is with us. He's a longtime Green Bay Packers reporter. He now writes about the Packers and the NFL for his own website, Bob McGinn Football. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Are you excited about seeing the Packers this year after the team's off-season changes? Will they beat the Bears on their other division rivals? What do you think about the new coach? What do you think about the team's fortunes looking like in 2019? We're at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Bob, who was the team's first pick, and what do we know about him?
His name is Rashawn Gary. He played at Michigan. He played 3 years there, then declared for the draft. He was the 12th selection in the first round. We know a lot about Rashawn Gary, especially that's my alma mater, and I know a lot about him because I pay very close attention to that program. I'm somewhat of a fan. Kate, he's a pick. I call him a gamble on greatness. He is the quintessential boom or bust pick. He has tremendous talent. He has all the traits to be a great player. He should have been a much more productive player at the University of Michigan, but he wasn't.
Why was that?
Injury really wasn't a factor. And this is the $64,000 question. Why doesn't he use his talent more? Some people think he's been entitled his whole career, that he came out of New Jersey as the number one ranked high school player in the entire country, and then he's been entitled and he hasn't worked that hard. Some people think he's a little bit lazy with his effort. Some people think he's not real physical for his size and his dimensions.
And he's big.
He is, 6'4 and a half, 276. Now, the real problems are, okay, number one, all of a sudden, will he turn the page, flip the coin, and become this go-getter? He's going to be playing an entirely new position. He played with his hand down in a three-point stance for the Wolverines. Now he's going to be standing up in a two-point stance. His 2 feet will be on the ground only.
Does that make a difference?
That's a major projection. You're looking at, you know, for 3 years in his whole life, he's been looking at the game with his hand down, you know, right near the ground. Now he's going to be standing up in space, so to speak. And this is, the opponents will definitely be trying to confuse him. I'll mention one more thing, Kate. He also has a shoulder injury, a shoulder that's kept popping out his last year at Michigan. This is probably, NFL teams believe, will lead to surgery at some point. And if it does, that's a 5 or 6 month recovery period. A lot of variables on this player.
The Packers selected a tight end with their fourth pick. Is he perhaps a new target for Aaron Rodgers?
Got to be. That's his strength. Some tight ends are good receivers. Some are more blockers, and he is the receiver. He's a kid who he's one of the most interesting guys in the draft. He played 2 years at Kansas with absolutely no success, went to a junior college in 2017, and then all of a sudden got a full ride to Texas A&M and blossomed overnight and had a terrific year. So he needs to, you know, further development, but there's a lot of skills and speed with this player.
And what is this player's name?
Jace Sternberger.
And where did Jace come out of?
Texas A&M, by way of Kingfisher, Oklahoma, population 4,000.
Well, we'll be watching. So did any of the Packers selections surprise you?
I was a little surprised in the second round, the second pick, you know, when the general manager traded up from number 30 to number 21, and to do so, he had to give up 2 fourth-round picks. And then he selected a safety from Maryland, Darnell Savage.
What do we know about Darnell Savage?
Darnell Savage is only 5'10 and a half, which is about an inch and a half below the prototype. He has great speed. He runs 40 yards in 4.35 seconds, and he's a really good kid from all accounts. He should be a good player. He better be, because the cost to the Packers of giving up those 2 fourth-round picks seemed exorbitant to some.
So Aaron Rodgers is 35 now. Do the Packers need to start having a plan yet for succession after Aaron Rodgers?
Well, it'd be nice to have it, but, you know, they have so many other needs, and I think, you know, Aaron has said he'd like to play to at least 40. So you can't get everything in a draft, and they just couldn't do that, and so that'll wait another year or two.
What role does Aaron Rodgers play as a leader on this team?
A very encompassing leader, a very large one. He takes leadership very seriously, and he spends a lot of time trying to talk to all areas of the locker room. Now, whether he's effective in this role depends on who you talk to, but he takes it very seriously.
The Packers entered the 2019 NFL Draft last weekend with 10 picks, but did the Packers make the grade in the NFL Draft? We're talking about it with Bob McGinn. He's a longtime Green Bay Packers reporter. He now writes about the Packers and the NFL for his own website. You have a line, 800-642-1234. Did you want to have the Packer, you know, you... Did you want to see better options for the Packers? You know, maybe you think the team should have picked a quarterback or somebody to replace Aaron Rodgers. What do you think? Is the team poised for a rebound, or will this be another rebuilding year? Call in. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Back in a moment, maybe hear from you on the Ideas Network. About the Packers' prospects for the 2019 season. Now the NFL draft is behind us. The Packers ended up with 8 players, and it's been a busy offseason as they've hired a new head coach, Matt LaFleur, and they signed 4 new players in free agency. Question is, will they have their first winning season since 2016? And who should we be watching for? Who stands out in this 53-player roster? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What was your reaction to the Packers' draft picks last week? Did the team address your concerns after last season? You can call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. Bob McGinn is our guide. He's a longtime Green Bay Packers reporter. Let's go to the phones now with Brian joining us from Sherwood. Hi, Brian.
Hi, good morning.
What's on your mind?
Hey, first I'd like to congratulate Bob on his success covering the draft over many years. He's sort of the draft savant, remarkable prediction ability. So, Bob, here's my question. In a pre-draft show on TV, WBAY did a recap showing that there's only 4 players remaining on Green Bay's team from the prior 36 players selected over 4 years. And really, that's the second least successful ratio in the NFL. What factors do you attribute to this lack of success, given the early success? So why did things change?
Oh, wow, well, great question.
Yeah, you know, Ted Thompson did, I think, 13 drafts, and he drafted really well in his early years and mid-years. In some ways, I think the law of averages just caught up, you know. He's drafting down low year after year. And, you know, it's hard to keep it up, and he had a really good record. And then his record in his later years was not as good. Other than that, I know Ted Thompson worked the same way. His staff really, he lost some very good scouts along with him to other teams as GMs. But he continued to work the way he did, and sometimes it's tough. And I don't know, just percentages got him, I think.
Brian, what do you see now in terms of the GM, and this is being his second drafting season? What do you see about the strategy?
You know, I think it's a challenge just having two or three key difference makers per draft. So I'm optimistic that he's ahead of the law of averages. I think there are some talented people. I think last year's core group, Jair Alexander, was a tremendous pick. So hopefully that first group of Goody's picks improves, and then hopefully hit on one or two difference makers. I know Ron Wolf used to say, if you get one or two difference makers, they really flip the field for you.
Mm. Bob, what about those difference makers?
Well, you got to have them. Teams use color codes to rate their rosters, and from top to bottom, it goes blue, red, purple, and then down about seven categories to a brown and white. You need blues, and really Green Bay – Rodgers hasn't played like a blue for several years. You have one in David Bakhtiari. You have a close one in Devontae Adams. And you don't have anybody on defense right now. So they need some players to step up a level.
So in March, the Packers signed four free agents. How did that affect what the Packers needed out of this draft?
Oh, a huge effect. I mean, they said goodbye to Nick Perry and Clay Matthews at outside linebacker. And to replace them, they signed Preston Smith from Washington and Za'Darius Smith from Baltimore. And, you know, had they not done that, they would have had to been, well, Gary does play that position. So I guess, but they probably would have had to draft another linebacker, and they would have been in a huge quandary trying to find a good pass rusher.
So here the Packers have hired a new coach. Lots of changes here in the offseason. We've got the draft. We have the free agents. Have these recent new players shed any light on the changes in the team's playbook coming up next year?
Well, they haven't been available yet, really, to do any talking, any of the new players. You know, Kate, so the way NFL teams operate now, you know, including the Packers, they don't really like to deal much with the media, and
but what is Matt LaFleur?
Very limited.
Yeah, what is Matt LaFleur's philosophy? How does he handle his team?
Don't know yet.
We just really don't know
enough, Kate.
Yeah,
we don't know.
So that's definitely a blind spot that we'll have to be watching for. You know, how do all these changes, this leadership shakeup, have an effect on a team? Do fans generally react well to change?
Fans do, yeah, and so do players, because it's a fresh start and everybody is excited, you know, with change and hope for the future. And, you know, that lasts you for several months, sometimes a first year if there's some, if the results spawn optimism. But, you know, you got to do it. And the NFL is a really what have you done for me lately business. It's a cutthroat industry, and you got to do it quick.
So you've been covering the Packers for 40 years. Can we say much about the team's outlook at this point? I mean, months before the season starts, do they have the pieces to make the playoffs? Can you even project at this point?
It's hard, Kate. You know, let's look at history. I was thinking back the records of the previous coaches in their first year in Green Bay. Excuse me. Mike McCarthy went 8-8. Mike Sherman went 9-7. Ray Rhodes went 8-8. Mike Holmgren went 9-7. Lindy Infante went 4-12. Forrest Gregg went 8-8. So you kind of see the picture. None of them made the playoffs in that first year. Now, none of them had a quarterback, as established as Aaron Rodgers. So it's going to be tough. We have to see what Matt LaFleur, it's his first gig. He's only been a coordinator calling plays 1 year. He's got a, this is a massive change for him, and we have no idea how he will perform under the gun with in a situation that is really, fans around here expect this team to win. They expect the playoffs despite two off years, and you know, this is a big job for him.
So after the draft, we also have a better look at some of the Packers' competitors. Which teams do the Pack have to worry about this year in their division?
I think the Chicago Bears with their defense, it returns mostly intact. The one player they lost was the safety Adrian Amos, and he came to Green Bay. So with their defense, the Bears are going to be good. The Lions are, I don't see them as a real contender. And the Vikings should be very good again. They were able to keep their defense intact with the re-signing of Anthony Barr. And so it looks like certainly a two-team race. And if Green Bay can improve, that would make it a three-team race.
Let's bring in Elaine calling from Colfax. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. I've always thought Aaron Rodgers was a beautiful quarterback, a perfectionist. And he just seemed completely unlike himself last year. I mean, he was missing very open receivers, and his timing was off. He seemed unhappy when he was interviewed, even kind of his dop was down, as my dad would say. It just did. I mean, it wasn't just his play. There was something about his attitude that was off, and I wonder if you could comment on that.
Thanks, Elaine.
Boy, yeah, I saw it too, Elaine. Some bad body language. Hard to say. I mean, it's very difficult to say what was going on. But the bottom line is he has to perform better. I mean, he's being paid more money than anybody in the league, and he is the face of this franchise, and he can't afford to let any outside factors, whether it be coaching, teammates, opposition, that's just the way it is. And he has to elevate his game back to where it was a few years ago.
So the Packers have seen lots of up and down since you've been covering the team through the decades. Is there another time in history that you think is comparable to where we're at right now?
Kate, when I started, they were terrible, you know? And and they were terrible basically from 79, my first year as a backup on the beat. I moved full-time to the beat in 84, and they were really bad until 91. And then at that point, they hired Ron Wolf as general manager, Mike Holmgren as coach, and traded for Brett Favre as quarterback, and the entire franchise changed. This is a down period, 2 years down. There is hope, certainly. They have some good, really good players, including the quarterback, who must shape up. It's hard to compare this little interlude to others. I it's a tough one.
Well, thank you for sticking with the beat. Thanks for joining us. Bob McGinn is a longtime Green Bay Packers reporter. He now writes about the Packers and the NFL for his own website, Bob McGinn Football. And we've been talking about last weekend's draft picks and how the Packers are setting up for the 2019 season. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're with us on the morning show. This is the Ideas Network. The Morning Show is produced by Colleen Leahy, Laura Pavin, Jana Rose Schleiss, Courtney Everett, Keegan Kyle, Chris Molina, and Brianne Shasso. Lee Rayburn is our technical director, and Keely Baltina is our executive producer. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.